mean something to me, I guess.
Welcome to another episode of the Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and today is March 30th, 2010, and this is episode 402. More about this program, the guests that provided us with such fascinating conversations, can be found on our website, www.exogenynetwork.com. Now, for everybody who likes to feel connected, you can find me on Facebook and Twitter, and link to me there. There's a Dawn of Shades fan page on Facebook, and you can look for that as well. There's lots of articles out there that you can read, and you can find all the links on the website, as well as there's a lot of stuff on the website as well. And if you have a question during the show tonight, you can email it to me at gscott@gmail.com. Send it to me through the virtual auditorium on Pal Talks by text as well. I do monitor both places during the program. And if you're listening on a podcast, go ahead and email me the question, and I'll try and get it answered for you as well. Now, tonight's guest is a man who has done more things than most of us have dared dream of, and written more than all too many Americans have ever read, even, with a resume that would do any modern hero proud. He's even established a foundation to continue researching called the Ancient Wisdom Foundation, which more information about can be found on our website, www.exogenynetwork.com. There's a page there for John Anthony West as well as for the Ancient Wisdom Foundation. So take a look at it. And I want to welcome John Anthony West to the program. Welcome. I'm glad that you have made it to talk with us tonight.
Thank you, Gia. And apologies to your audience that they were expecting me on at 8 o'clock. I can't even blame it on premature Alzheimer's. And it wouldn't be premature anyway.
Well, just in case there's somebody listening that might not be familiar with who you are, kind of give them a nutshell introduction to who John Anthony West is.
All right. Who, me?
Oh. Yeah, you.
I'm supposed to tell them. Oh, I thought you were.
Yeah, you know better than everybody else.
Well, yeah, but I mean, how do you know I'm telling the truth?
Well, that makes it all the more entertaining now, doesn't it?
Well, okay. Briefly, I wear two different hats, actually. One is quite well known, my Egyptological pith helmet. I sometimes describe myself as a rogue Egyptologist or an alternative or independent Egyptologists, depending upon who I'm talking to and how angry I want to get them. And the other is my Bohemian beret. That's what I started off life wearing, writing plays and novels and screenplays, and then got sidetracked into Egypt some 40 years ago or so, and it's pretty much held me ever since. I'm, I guess you might say, one of the chief exponents of what is called symbolist Egyptology, which is an interpretation of Egypt developed by a genius French scholar with an unpronounceable name of R.A. Schwalle de Lubitsch. And he lived for many years in Egypt and basically turned the whole discipline upside down, proving with impeccable scholarship, actually, that the academics have Egypt all wrong, and that rather than a precursor to Greek civilization, where civilization really started, the Egyptians were at a level of sophistication actually so advanced that it's only in modern times that we're able to appreciate what they actually knew. In other words, we had to get our knowledge up to a very advanced level in physics and chemistry and all sorts of things, medicine, of course, before we could actually appreciate how advanced the Egyptians were. Even though, if you're in Egypt and you spend a little bit of time there, you can't miss how brilliant they were because of the level of the art and the architecture. And you don't have to be, for example, a good Christian to understand the truth of "by their fruits you shall know them." So when you see a civilization that devotes itself to divine principles, the so-called gods, which really shouldn't be called gods because that makes them sound very superstitious, but divine principles, a sacred science, it's only people at that level of sophistication and accomplishment who are capable of producing art and architecture of this nature. And the contrast between, when you go there especially, you can read about it, you can look at pictures, but I often say, actually, Egypt is like sex. And people say, "Oh, why is Egypt like sex?" And I say, well, you can read all about it, and you can even look at pictures, but until you've experienced it, you don't actually understand the damn thing. So Egypt is like that. And in any event, symbolist Egyptology makes sense of this entire extraordinary civilization. I'm one of a number of people who have picked up on Shwela de Luvet. Shwela died in the 60s, and we put the message out as best we can, introducing them to, one, a great civilization that teaches us the difference between real civilization and what we have, which is we call progress, and it's, again, by their fruits you shall know them. So whereas the Egyptians had temples and pyramids built to the gods and built to the divine principles, so we have carpet bombs and napalm and atom bombs and traffic jams and all sorts of things like that. And that's progress. We also have a few good things, but I wouldn't want to give up my computer, and here I am talking to you all on the telephone, so it's not all bad. But there's a big difference between a civilization and progress, and it's in Egypt that we get to understand the difference. So, is that coherent?
that is coherent. And it kind of brings to mind a lot of questions. Most of us, you know, at least in the United States, we were spoon-fed a nice, watered-down version of Egyptian history. You know,
that's
they
right.
built pyramids to bury their kings in, and their kings were worshipped as gods, practically, And they did a few important things, like invent paper with papyrus, and they did this and they did that, and you know, it really didn't tell you much about the people at all. And then you've got the biblical stories of Moses being found in, you know, in the bulrushes in a basket, and then, you know, all that stuff too, you know, which, you know, most of us are going to remember from some exposure at some point to biblical history. And, you know, that really doesn't create a very intriguing picture of the Egyptians.
No.
And then, you know, as adults, you read other things, you know, and you remember snippets. Like, I read someplace that somebody had the theory, I can't even tell you who, but that the pyramids were actually some sort of an energy transmission system. I find that quite intriguing, but I've never found anything else about it.
Oh, that would be Christopher Dunn, probably. The Giza power plant.
That could be, you know.
Probably.
And it was something that I read quite a while ago now. And then nobody seems to talk about it anymore. So you hear these little snippets about somebody found the makings of an ancient battery, you know, in some temple someplace.
No, that's in Baghdad. And they
okay.
did. Yeah, yeah, that's for sure. And the pyramid...
See, all this gets garbled up in the average mind.
Yeah, it does. And the pyramid is an energy transmission of some sort. So if you're talking about Chris Dunn's book, he's a good friend of mine. And actually, he wrote that book, and I think he's rethought. He had the hypothesis in the book that they were producing electricity with the pyramid. And I think he's recanted from that position somewhat. But he still thinks it's an energy device of some sort, and I absolutely agree with that. The pyramid, it's not a temple. It's not the place where you
Now, I don't know if you would know if this is true or not, that the temples, that these pyramids are visible from space.
Pyramids are what?
That the temples are visible from orbit in space, like the space station.
The temples or the pyramids?
The pyramids, rather.
Oh, probably, sure. I mean, they're gigantic. But I'm convinced also that they do something. I mean, the pyramids, the temples, you feel something. I mean, they also do something, but the pyramids, they're some sort of, I mean, put it this way, Egypt is a one-issue civilization. Everything in Egypt that remains, I mean, you know, on the mundane level, people, you know, fought with each other and loved and got divorced and did all of the things that other human beings do, but the focus, the single-minded focus of their entire civilization was the quest for immortality. In other words, the understanding was that through the right kind of life and the right kinds of actions and the right kinds of ceremonies, consciously pursued, human beings could arrive at a level of consciousness where the body dies, yes, but the level of consciousness, the conscious self, lives on. And in fact, that's the basis of all the religions, no matter how garbled they've become over time. And that's the purpose of Christianity, it's the purpose of Islam, it's the purpose of Judaism. If you look hard enough, it's there. So it's not as though this is anything, you know, outrageous or anything different from what other religions have. But the Egyptians, this was their single-minded focus, and so everything that they do and did was directed toward that aim. And the pyramid must in some way or another be a device for raising consciousness, for enabling that process to take place. I'm not sure, but I do know, I mean, because I go there all the time and I lead trips there, and we always rent the Great Pyramid for a 2-hour private meditation session, and with very few people who come out of that meditation session unchanged. I mean, people know that they have been, and they have been somewhere absolutely unique and absolutely special, and that they've experienced something can't be put into words, but something profound that they've never experienced before. And that's normal. Some people get it much more powerfully than others. Everyone gets something different, generally speaking, but very rarely does someone come out of that pyramid unmoved. So, in other words, it does something. It has an effect, and it's not just romanticizing something. I mean, you can go into your bathroom and sit down and meditate for 2 hours. It's not the same as being in the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid. So.
I have such a hard time believing that each pyramid was built for the sole purpose of preserving one mummy.
Yeah, of course. I mean, actually, of all of the theories of pyramids, and there are lots of them. They were built by aliens. They were a gigantic hydraulic ram pump. They were things. They were a bunch of different, all kinds of different reasons. The one that's at least as unproved any of the others is exactly that they were tombs. No evidence has ever been found that they were originally intended as tombs, although in a couple of the pyramids, much later burials have indeed been, you know, been discovered, but it's known that those were later burials. So, and they absolutely don't work as tombs. In other words, other pyramids that were tombs, and, you know, the innumerable Egyptian funerary structures all have a kind of a funerary logic. Here is the mummy, and there are, you know, the reliefs and the paintings and the sculptures, and here are the funerary furniture. Everything has, it all has a place. It all has its own internal logic, even though we wouldn't necessarily do something like that today. But the pyramids defy explanation. They're all different from each other. They absolutely wouldn't function as tombs, no funerary, there are no inscriptions in any of them. There was no funerary furniture found. And for example, when normally when there's a tomb and it gets violated all the time when the infrastructure of Egypt breaks down, the tomb robbers come in and steal all the gold and the jewelry, but they leave everything else hanging around. I mean, there were no Dutch tomb robbers who cleaned up after themselves. So when the pyramids were first broken into or entered by the early archaeologists, they were absolutely bare. There was nothing in there. And, for example, even a thing like a stone sarcophagus, some of them don't have that stone sarcophagus, or anyway, the lid is missing. Well, the lid weighs a few tons, and it's very difficult to get the lid out of there, and no lid was ever found. So what happened to the lid? We don't know. So loads of questions remain about those pyramids, but absolutely, you're right. A, there's no evidence that they were ever tombs, and B, they would make unbelievably unsatisfactory tombs, and the amount of work that's gone into those pyramids is completely mind-boggling, and all you can say is look back at them in wonder, recognize, acknowledge that we don't really know what they were meant to do or what their purpose was, but that it must have been very important to the people who did them, because it's not like, you know, it's not like putting together a Lego set. It's just incredible.
Well, you know, even if you had modern machinery and you were building those things, our best machinery available, it would still be an immense investment.
It might not even be possible, actually.
Right, well,
there are a lot of problems involved in those pyramids that we don't have the machinery for. Probably, given that we can fly to the moon, if it were important to us to figure out a way to do it with machinery, probably we could do it. But with the machinery that we have, we couldn't.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and so, you know, as a, you know, average person, you know, halfway across the world, thinking about the pyramids, I'm thinking, you know, they just really don't work for tombs, even if it was a society that worshipped ancestors. That's an incredible amount of devotion, you know?
That's right, it is.
Yeah, yeah, and so you have to question. You know, another thing that people always talk about is what's under the Sphinx.
Is what?
What is under the Sphinx?
Ah, well.
You know, I've heard a lot of people saying there's something magical, mystical, and really important there, and there's no way the Egyptian government is ever going to let anybody use any kind of equipment to investigate what lies beneath the
Sphinx. Well, maybe. Hang on. Actually, it would in fact be not easy to excavate there, because it's under this. I mean, we're sure that there's a chamber under the paw of the Sphinx because our seismograph found it, and our seismograph was not psychic. It didn't channel extragalactic entities or anything of the sort.
Right.
And according to our seismograph, there's a chamber there, and we believe our seismograph because at the very rear end of the Sphinx, there's also a chamber. And the geophysicist who was working with us, working the seismograph, he didn't know about that other chamber at the back end. And he said, gee, look at that, there's a chamber at the back end, because he could see that in the readout. I mean, the seismograph gives you what's in effect, you might say, it's like an X-ray of what there is underground. And so, according to that X-ray, there is a chamber in front of the Sphinx. However, it's under about five meters, about 15 feet of bedrock. And we had a rough time when we were working with the seismograph, because we were being kicked out. They were trying to get rid of us, and we were being kicked around by the authorities. So we couldn't really do the work as carefully or as much of it as we would have liked. And so we've not discovered if there is a chamber, then there has to be an entry into the chamber. And we couldn't find an entry passageway. However, if we succeed, and this is the plan that's afoot at the moment, if we succeed in proving in a manner that's unchallengeable that the Sphinx is much, much older than it's supposed to be, at some point or another, the authorities will have to turn around and get interested in this demonstrated but alternative idea. And at some point or another, if it becomes important enough to them, if they themselves get interested in figuring out what, if anything, is in that chamber, then just maybe, at least they could stick a fiber optic camera down through a small hole. But excavating, and you see that it's quite, as I said, it's under about 15 feet of bedrock, and the water table has risen, so that chamber is almost certainly filled with water. So excavation would be unbelievably difficult. They'd have to build some sort of a cofferdam, or they'd have to set something up that would pump the water out as fast as it was coming in. And since the Sphinx is a very fragile structure, I mean, it's huge, but it's very ruinous, this would be a very, very delicate process. So at the moment, it's absolutely true to say they're not interested and they don't want to know. But it's not impossible that in the not too distant future they might want to know, and then we'll see. And it's called, you know, it's the Edgar Casey said that there would be something found there, and it would be the Hall of Records giving the history of Atlantis. Well, I wouldn't bet on that, but then Casey had a great record for his medical diagnoses, but his prophecies were unfortunately nowhere near as trustworthy as his medical work. So we just don't know. But that's where the idea comes from Casey, that there's something mystical and magical and marvelous under the Sphinx.
And so that leads to kind of another, you know, question. Why is the Egyptian government apparently in such strong opposition to any change in the way that Egyptian history is perceived?
It's not specific to Egypt, actually. It isn't even extreme. Academics, anybody in the worlds of scholarship and science, whichever discipline it may be, the nature of an establishment is that it believes it is in, it possesses the truth, and it guards that truth with its life, as it were. In other words, to come out of left field, as we have done, and tell all of these people with their PhDs and 30 years of work behind them that, gee, guys, I'm very sorry, but you got it all wrong. The last thing in the world is that any academic or any scientist wants to admit is, I was wrong. So it's,
well,
really,
I think that's true for all of us.
It's really a psychological thing, but we're working on changing that, actually. Well, we're working on changing it by, too complicated to explain, but we hope to be able in pretty quickly to demonstrate, and it, strangely enough, it isn't even in Egypt that we're, it's in Turkey that we're, there's this extraordinary structure, which the archaeologists themselves date to about 10,000 BC. And that's, at that date, one of the problems with our Sphinx theory is that the academics all say, oh, well, there's no civilization back then. How could they have built this incredible thing? It's all hunter-gatherers. But there's this extraordinary structure in southern Turkey that they date to 10,000 BC, and that is a pretty elaborate stone structure built of big slabs, elegantly carved. And so that gets rid of the objection once and for all that there's no such civilization capable of building with large blocks of stone. So that's a big step forward. But I'm actually fairly optimistic that as long as I live long enough and don't give up the quest, which I will certainly not do, sooner or later enough people will have to, well, you know, with the people in positions of authority, at least the young people, we'll have to acknowledge and say, you know, well, we were wrong about this. It really is much older. And then where does that take us? And then at that point, new things really do start to happen. So it is as you say. I mean, they're very obdurate about it, and they don't want to know. But that's nothing particular to them. That holds true in any scientific or scholarly discipline in the world. The people who, put it this way, our work turns over the apple cart and they make a living selling apples. It's as simple as that.
Yeah, well, you know, like I said, you know, all of us, not just academia,
yeah,
all of us really hate to be shown that we are wrong.
Exactly. Particularly the men. Women aren't
well,
that bad.
You know, once upon a time, perhaps women were more willing to accept the concept of they're wrong. But I would say over time, you know, that shifted a little bit because I know a lot of people who know me are going to be very shocked at my admission here. I'm known for being a little bit hard-headed, you know. However, eventually, you pound enough evidence down in front of me, I'm going to have to admit that I was wrong. And I have actually had to even publicly admit I was wrong on occasion, yeah. And,
well,
you know, fess up.
Yeah, yeah, but
that,
see, you
okay.
Just proved the point. You're a woman. A guy would never admit that.
Ah, well. No, it was kind of a thing, you know, that my denial of it as a possible truth had been just as public as the proving that it was the truth. So it was a case of, you know, you really have to admit I was wrong. And, you know, is it painful? Yeah, but you feel a whole lot better when it's over with.
Right, yeah. Listen,
you know, and it is. It's hard to admit that you are wrong.
Well, when you've
but, you know, the Egyptian government, you know, the Department of Antiquities or whatever it is, you know, most people have seen things that they've put, you know, press releases or articles about them that have, you know, stated that they were basically stonewalling against all kinds of new ideas or new tests or measurements or observations or, you know, however you want to put it. Even things that were non-intrusive, you know, they weren't going to change anything. You know, you wouldn't like you had to drill a chunk out of that thing and take it home with you. You were just going to measure it, and it was going to be unchanged. And, you know, still, they would resist it. They would refuse to give permits. They wouldn't let people work.
Well,
so, do you find that to be true?
Yes and no. The rule is, and it's actually not a stupid rule. In one sense, it's a stupid rule, that you can only get permission to excavate and do official work there if you're connected with or if it's sponsored by a bona fide university. So that in and of itself more or less excludes anybody with a new and fresh idea, because most of those new and fresh ideas don't come out of the universities. However, if they didn't have that, it would be very difficult to, I mean, you'd have, you know, everybody and his brother wanting to chip away at the Sphinx or chip away at the pyramids. It really would be pretty chaotic, especially in Egypt. It wouldn't be so bad in certain other places, but
right.
Egypt is an enthusiast playground, and if it were open season, it really would be difficult to monitor. That said, yes, by keeping it strictly academic, they pretty much absolve themselves from finding out anything that they don't already know. This is true. But as I said, these things do change, as a general rule, very, very slowly, but at a certain point, if the evidence is commanding enough, and nowadays, in the old days, I mean, there was no other way of getting the message out to large numbers of people, you know, except by books, and even that would only reach certain numbers of people. But nowadays, with the media at our beck and call, you can get the message out to millions of people virtually instantaneously. And if enough people get interested and start making a lot of noise, things can happen a lot more quickly than they used to happen, or that used to be possible. So this is a
possibility. Right. I mean, the internet, I think, has been a wonderful thing for especially alternative pursuits, as we might call them.
Right.
Things outside of the mainstream, because for the first time, that it's over the last 20 years, it's kind of been open forum.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can put information out instantly that's available across the world.
That's right.
And there's programs like this one and you know, the others on this network and numerous other networks on the internet that talk about all sorts of alternative information.
That's right.
It's a fresh and new outlook because I don't have a degree in journalism. I don't have a degree in anything.
Well.
And, you know, I see things the way I see them.
Right.
I was convicted long ago of being, you know, that horrible thing called an independent thinker.
Yes.
You know, and you talk about academia and not liking that sort of thing. You see that very, very early. I mean, my daughter, I can remember being called into the school, and the school psychologist announces that my daughter suffers from independent thinking like she had a social disease. And, you know, then he looks at me and says, I do as well. And I'm thinking, well, wasn't I supposed to raise someone that thought independently? Well, apparently not. That's not a good thing, you know.
Oh, well, that's right.
You know, she's still a quite independent thinker, and, you know, she doesn't like to be inside the box, and she doesn't play by the rules.
Right.
And that's just the way it's going to be, I guess.
Well, that's good. How old is she?
She's 27.
Oh, well, yeah, she's well out of the box, right?
Oh, yeah. She's well out of school. And you know, she wasn't formally educated in a normal manner, and, you know, the whole thing. And so she's never had to think inside the box. I mean, you know, history class for her was frequently we would go visit a ruin ourselves, and she could, you know, talk to archaeologists sometimes that were working, or she might be able to just wander around, and depending on where we were going. And now, granted, it was within the United States, but, you know, she got to explore things one-on-one and make up her own mind.
Well, that's right.
Nobody told her what was right.
My kid's the same way. And actually, I have a rather good response. Sometimes I'm challenged by either academics or, you know, skeptics or whatever, and who say, well, you know, what credentials do you have to be talking about Egypt? And my stock answer is, I don't have any credentials. That's why I know something. So.
Yeah. I can remember long, long ago, I was a tour guide.
You were?
Yeah, I was.
Where?
In Arizona.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, people would ask me, what are your, you know, educational qualifications? And I'm standing there and I'm thinking, for a little bit over minimum wage, you want educational qualifications? I couldn't afford to pay a student loan on this. And, you know, I would laugh and I would say, you know, I descend from a long line of car dealers, politicians, preachers, and teachers, you know. I don't need and horse traders. And I don't need the Blarney Stone, you know.
That's right.
You know, and it was sort of a joking but truthful answer, you know, deflecting the actual point, which, you know, it was, I just really found the idea that many people with an education assume that because someone doesn't have a degree, they are an idiot.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's, of course, we are conditioned into thinking that way. So, actually, if you buy into that, well, then the brainwashing has worked.
Yeah, well, you know, and I'm sure it's true for you and many people that you know as well. Education is something that needs to continue throughout your life, not through a 4-year degree.
Well, that's right. I mean, a piece of paper that you've
hang on the wall as you slam the doors to your mind closed.
Yes, I mean, all that proves is that you can do as you're told.
Basically. Right, right. No,
yeah,
I did it at college.
Mostly creative people and genuinely original thinkers either hated their education or disavowed it at some point or another, or didn't have it at all. Because the nature of creativity is basically antithetical to academic, and by academic I don't mean scholarly. Academic I use as a, you know, in other words, as a sort of an ivory tower, where mediocrities try to keep themselves safe from people like ourselves.
Well, you know, we can joke about it to a degree, but if you educate yourself to enter a field and you are incapable of performing and obtaining a job doing that function, whatever you're trained to do, there's always one career left to you: teaching.
Yeah, that's right. Well,
you know, I found it amazing, you know, taking creative writing courses in college, the people that are teaching me how to write poems and prose and plays and novels and everything have never had anything published.
Well, that's often the case. Sometimes not. Sometimes you get, I mean, it's very difficult to make a living out of writing, so sometimes
right,
you get people
but, you know,
really
in reality, in a small college, that's what I had.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm thinking, you know, how do you really justify telling me that this is wrong when obviously you aren't doing something
that's right?
Right.
Yeah, there's a, it's a line, it's an old, I forget who it was who said it, but it's those who can do, those who can't teach.
Unfortunately, it's often true.
It's often true. Not always, but often.
Yeah. Well, especially, I would say, you know, at your undergraduate level, you're more likely, I think, to encounter that. And that's where most people stop their education.
Usually. Actually, in the arts, it's often not that bad because it's so difficult to make a living out of any of the arts that often, I mean, I know locally where I live, and it's sort of out in the sticks, but the local community colleges, not even the regular colleges, the community colleges, have really good people teaching. You know, they're all working painters and sculptors and writers who do get published, and but just can't live off it, so that's what they do.
Well, you know, I have to admit, I did have some teachers that were very, very qualified. The art teacher that I had, you know, she was quite good at what she'd done, and she also, you know, she was an artist.
I
felt quite comfortable with what she was teaching me.
Right.
However, in my creative writing class, I really questioned it, you know?
Well, yeah. Yes, if you've managed, if you're teaching a creative writing class and you've never actually been published, it's a bit like, you know, reading a cookbook by someone who's never fried an egg.
There's many books out there, though, all about rearing children by people who've never had a
never
child.
Had them, right. Although, you know, actually, I'll tell you a funny little story, actually. When my first short story was published, it was a long time ago, 57 to be exact, and I remember when that first check came, because up until that time, and I was still pretty young, I mean, I didn't think I was that young, but I was 24, That was my banner day. I actually count that as my birthday, the regular birthday. Who cares? I mean, I had nothing to do with that. But this was my real birthday. And I remember when that check came through, and it was from a very prestigious magazine that no longer exists. And I remember reading, getting, you know, whoopee, I'm a writer. And then suddenly the thought struck me that was, gee, you know, this story, it is what it is. And it could just as well have been rejected. So sometimes good stuff isn't recognized, and so somebody, in theory at any rate, you know, sometimes people, really good people, like Van Gogh never sold a painting. So it's not impossible that you could have a writing teacher or a poetry teacher who hasn't been published, but who really is good. But that would be a super rarity.
Right.
Actually,
well, you know, I think about, you know, all right, living in New Orleans, we have many, many artists of many, many kinds. And you go down in the French Quarter and you wander around and they're selling paintings like crazy to tourists. And it's utter total garbage.
Right, yeah, well.
Well, they are a working painter and they are selling, but,
right.
You know.
Exactly.
Yeah. But, yeah, there is quite a bit. They may as well be stamping out, you know, with a machine because it's identical stuff. I've looked at the same stuff by the same half dozen people for years now.
Yeah. Are you actually in New Orleans?
Well, I live across the canal in Metairie, one of the suburbs, but yeah,
ah.
I live in New Orleans.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so, I get to go to the French Quarter quite often.
Ah, that's nice. I've never been to New Orleans.
Yeah, if you want a surreal experience, and I don't know if it'll ever happen the way it did, but that first winter after Katrina.
Yes.
I spent a lot of time down in the French Quarter because for the first time, we didn't have very many tourists.
Right.
And there wasn't a whole lot going on down there, so it was, you know, it smelled fresh and clean, not like it normally had.
Yeah.
And, you know, I spent a lot of time that winter down there. And I just go down there and watch people and talk to the street people and just, you know, be down there, just because it was fascinating. It was different, you know.
Yes.
And I can remember one night I was down there, and it's, you know, of course dark. It gets dark early in the winter, and the fog rolls in off of the Mississippi River. And as the fog rolls in, you know, it's like all of a sudden your whole world is becoming much smaller, and it would, you know, creep down the streets and everything. And so, you know, it was a real surreal, painterly-like experience, because you would have, like, a street light and a light, you know, one person leaning against the post. You really saw those things. I mean, I've seen many tourist paintings done like that, but
yeah,
that doesn't really, you know, it doesn't really look like that. And all of a sudden, it would. I mean, everything else is grayed out, you know, and you have just this one little view.
Yeah.
Or you might have one person, you know, their head down, and they're scurrying along the sidewalk.
Yes.
And that's all you can see.
Mm-hmm.
And the sounds are gone. You can hear, you know, the horns of the boats on the river, which kind of just adds to the eeriness of the experience. And it was just a whole different thing, you know, that immense thick fog and how it just swallowed up the French Quarter.
Yes.
And everything became just a little narrow street, and the little street lights and the flickering gas lights on the, you know, by the doorways.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you know, a very, I mean, the movie companies should have been down there, because they could have got great views that, you know, when that was going on like that. It was completely different. And, you know, you can get that any winter, but, you know, you're going to be waiting until the wee hours of the morning for just the right circumstances for that fog to roll in. And, you know, this was a case of, you know, fog would roll in the evening, and everything was pretty much shut down by 6 o'clock,
mm-hmm,
even in the French Quarter, because there wasn't hardly anybody around.
Right.
I can remember, you know, people from out of the area complaining, because even Christmas Eve, everything was shut early. And they're complaining, and I'm thinking, well, you know, people want to shop, but there's nobody to run the store.
Right, yeah.
You know, they can only do so many hours in a day.
Yeah.
And because there wasn't. I mean, anybody can find a job. You can find a job, as I put it, you can find a job here if you're stupid and lazy.
Hmm. Yeah,
it's no longer the case, but, yeah, at that time, if you were stupid and lazy, you could still find a job. Yeah. I'd be working, you know, even in my yard, and people would be coming, trying to talk me into going to work for them.
Really?
It's like, no. I got enough to do. Thank you very much. Yeah, I mean, people were desperate for help. And,
really? Yeah, I know. I heard.
They would try to hire anybody that was breathing.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's about all you had to be doing was breathing.
Yeah.
I'm not even sure if you had to stand upright. But times have changed, and you know, that's the case of many, many other things. What, you know, when I think about the changes that have happened here and how quickly life could have been, you know, really even more drastically changed here.
Mm-hmm.
If such a disaster was part of the reason of the end of the initial civilization that created the pyramids, would that explain why there was this transition with no apparent memory continuing of the prior civilization?
Well, it may be, actually. I mean, it's complicated in that the pyramids that are there today are probably built, or most of it was built when they're supposed to have been built in the old kingdom of Egypt around 2500 BC. But they are demonstrably, the what's there today is either replaces or is superimposed upon the remains and the stumps of structures that were there before. And all of this, I mean, the ice age, the end of the last ice age, happened at about 10,000-11,000 BC, and nobody really knows why that happened. It's pretty well, it's established that it did happen, and that it was catastrophic, and the theories, various theories, it was some sort of a comet strike or some kind of massive global disaster that put an end to those civilizations that were there, which would have included Egypt. And that thereafter, I mean, the knowledge was retained, or a lot of the knowledge was retained, but sporadically, so that for quite a few thousands of years, there isn't much that we would call, let's say, sophisticated civilization, there isn't much of that, but there's some, and there's enough so that you see that it isn't all hunter-gatherers. This is what we're going to be doing in a couple of weeks, well, a couple of months, going to Turkey to look at this extraordinary site that's dated to 10,000 BC. And if there's that site, that can't have been the only sophisticated stone structure built about 10,000 BC. There have to be other things, or the remains of other things, that just haven't been discovered. This is a very important discovery, actually. But, yes, to answer your question, something cataclysmic must have happened to practically erase what had been there before, if we're correct about our Sphinx theory. So, and I'm very certain that we are. So, there's something going on at a very high level, and then all of a sudden there's much, much less of it, although more than I would have thought 25 years ago when I started doing this work, or 40 years ago when I started doing this work. We keep on accumulating bits and pieces of evidence, and when you put those bits and pieces together, though each one isn't necessarily particularly spectacular, each one is, by its nature, quite compelling. And when you put them all together, you build a real case for a lot of knowledge percolating down through the ages from a still earlier time when it was presumably common knowledge.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, recently I'd been doing some research on heirloom strains of grain, which, you know, don't ask, it's a long story, but, you know, I was in the process of researching that. You know, a grain that it was relatively new to the American market is called kamut or something like that. It's spelled K-A-M-U-T. And I remember reading that it was pretty much a type of wheat. And so I was happened to be reading about it the other day, and I had never heard this story before, and it had the history in this article that I was reading. And it supposedly had originated from a handful of grain a World War II soldier had picked up at a pyramid in Egypt.
Yeah.
Which I found kind of, you know, interesting. And he had given like 30 grains to somebody who mailed it to his father in Montana, who had raised it, and he'd periodically give jars of this seed to other people. And it had pretty much been forgotten. It lost its novelty. And one jar was obtained by a family, and, you know, a number of years later, and they started raising it again. And, you know, now it's you can buy bread made with this grain, or you can buy the flour or the grain itself.
Yes.
And that it's supposed to be really, really good for you. And, you know, they're saying that they think it was a land-based type of grain that originated in Egypt. And, you know, the whole story, you know, it sounds rather fanciful, like something somebody had cooked up. I mean, you know, how many soldiers were really able to get a handful of grain from a pyramid?
Yeah, I exactly.
but, you know, it probably did come from Egypt from what I have read about it. But, you know, that brings up, you know, because it's different than the other kinds of wheat. Its nutritional content is dramatically different and so forth and so on, which indicates it is a different strain. And, you know, that leads back to, again, you know, where did it originate from? You know, is it something different left over from an ancient civilization? You know, is it like, you know, pre-dynastic Egyptian culture, whatever we want to call it? Was it genetically engineered, you know, wheat that they grew? You know, what's the story on it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Because it does. It brings up more questions than really the little story that I read answered. Because, like I said, I kind of took that story and went,
Yeah, has anybody studied this particular wheat or grain?
Well, you know, it's being raised commercially now. And like I said, you can buy seed, you can buy flour, you can buy bread made, commercially made.
What's
bread.
What's it called?
It's spelled K-A-M-U-T.
Oh, yeah, Kamut. Yeah. I mean, which is the ancient name for Egypt.
Right.
But,
that's
but is
from.
It, again, is it, you know, has anybody looked at its genetic structure or anything like that?
Yes, somebody had, because that's why they concluded it was a land-raised species from Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
It's a humpbacked kind of fat grain, you know, from the photograph and the description. And, you know, I found it was a rather interesting story. And, you know, it had a completely different story from the other strains that I was reading about when I was reading about, you know, wheat and barley and so forth and so on, all these grains that were used. And reading some recipes, it sounded like I was very thankful that we now eat the kind of bread that we do eat, whether it's whole wheat, whole grain, or whatever.
Yeah.
It was much better than what people of ancient times was eating. Now, anybody who was eating the various Native American breads made with corn that are flavored with juniper ash, or the ones made from the beans of the mesquite tree or whatever, once again, you have to say, you know, modern palates really aren't suited for this.
Well, that's one thing. Modern palate's not suited to that, but guaranteed when you go to Egypt and you look at, let's say, when they have the offering tables, or you look when they're portraying a feast, it was a pretty sophisticated culinary tradition. So you bet they will have had, I mean, they would have had pretty spectacular food up and down the line, exactly what their wheat was like.
Well,
I think,
if they had wheat, they undoubtedly
had wheat. And
originated there in that area.
You know, actually, the guy was finding the grains in the pyramid. No, that doesn't make sense. But somebody could have got, I mean, you know, somebody from one of the tombs or something like that. They're coming up with stuff like that all the time. Or it's not absolutely inconceivable that, you know, that people just kept that strain of wheat going. You know, like,
right.
Some little pocket of farmland, and they just kept it going in the family and passed it on.
I was actually surprised to find out how many old strains of various kinds of grain that are still raised commercially in the United States that are raised by families, you know, for whatever reason, because in terms of farm profitability, they aren't as profitable as modern strains would be. But in terms of preserving genetic diversity, they are incredibly valuable that they still exist.
And the people who have them probably weren't thinking of genetic diversity. They just said, well, this is our stuff, and my grandfather and great-grandfather raised these kinds of tomatoes, and I'm going to raise them too, and I don't give a damn if I don't make as much money.
Right.
Yeah,
and,
I mean,
you know, and recently the preservation or conservation of these so-called heirloom varieties of all sorts of farm crops, from trees to grain to garden vegetables and flowers.
Yeah, well, now
it's important.
Yeah,
now we know
it's absolutely crucial so that Monsanto doesn't take over the world. Yeah,
well,
now it's really important.
Future generations may need that genetic contribution to cause further alteration in their hybrids. But its preservation is important. The heirloom breeds of livestock, same scenario. They were bred to fit very specific, unique niches in climate and environment and so forth. You know, like the dairy cows that were bred for hundreds, thousands of years to produce milk on just grass.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the modern milk cow can't do that.
Right.
You know, it's impossible. Same thing with beef cattle. Beef cattle don't get nice, big, and fat when they're grazing in a field.
Yeah. That's right.
Not the modern breeds. The old-fashioned breeds, yeah, they do.
Well, you know, in Egypt, you know, in the Bible somewhere along where the prodigal son comes home and they kill the fatted calf. Well, in Egypt, you see that they force-fed animals to produce the equivalent of a Strasbourg goose that you get the huge liver from that you make,
pâté
de foie gras. So Egypt had, you know, specially fed, probably grain-fed, cattle, steer, and you see them, these great massive, you know, overweight-looking cattle that they're sacrificing for their feast. So, for example, you have the beer in Egypt, pretty good these days, but the wine is pretty awful, and you know that they had wine in ancient times, and you can bet that it wasn't the stuff that they have now. Because they were, you know, everything that they did in Egypt was tremendously, In the physical world, it was an interesting blend of the spiritual and the physical, because they really paid attention to their creature comforts, you know? I mean, this huge, very varied cuisine, and, you know, drinks of all kinds, and perfumes of all kinds, and flowers of all kinds, and they really knew how to pamper themselves physically. And at the same time, of course, it was this, the whole thing was driven by this focus on the doctrine of immortality,
BSA,
on the quest,
the most advanced,
you know,
voice
the,
analysis
on eternal life.
Available
so, in other words, you don't have to retreat to the desert and weave mats and be celibate in order to follow a spiritual path. And the Egyptians seem to have been quite brilliant at combining the best of both possible worlds.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, I look at modern society, and we have perfected the art of pursuing the physical in terms of our science, our technology, our industry. You know, we've made immense strides in the last 200 years. You know, we've done far more than anyone could have really dreamed. But when you look in terms of our spirituality and our emotional, you know, our non-physical portions, we have gone virtually nowhere. If not,
yep, we've gone somewhere down.
Yeah, well, you know, if not gone backwards, we've not made any progress. And, you know, recently I was having a discussion with someone about psychology and the fact that it's really kind of a soft science that, you know, anybody can really debate a lot of the so-called truth.
Yes.
And make some very valid points about, because, you know, we really don't know that much about how our own minds work. In terms of why we do some of the things that we do. In some ways, we know a lot, but in other ways, no, we really don't know, or we wouldn't have mental hospitals to this day.
Well, that's right.
You know, yeah. We'd be able to fix the problem. But the thing is that, you know, it's like I see us as a species having to play catch-up, sort of like a kid, you know, that advanced real quick in one academic area but lagged behind his peers in other areas, and then suddenly, you know, he has to bring everything else back up, you know, to the same level. We see that with children all the time.
Yes.
And, you know, we're like a child of the universe. You know, it's
time for our
non-physical side.
Well, we've lost the sense, and I mean, it's, not only have we lost it, we have it beaten out of us. We've lost the sense that we mean anything. Actually, we've lost the sense of purpose. And of course, contemporary science, at its rationalist and materialist level, is dedicated to the principle of meaninglessness. So without that, without the understanding that on a personal level, and actually on a collective level as well, how we behave, what we do, what we believe makes a big difference. And without it, there is no meaning. I mean, if you believe that life is meaningless, nothing is going to have any meaning for you, and you're going to go around in circles for as long as you keep going. If psychology, and it depends which psychology you're talking about, you know, Jung is one thing and Freud is quite another, and behavioral psychology is quite another thing again. So depends, you know, you've got to choose your psychologist if you're going to have a meaningful discussion about the, as you say, the soft science, which effectively is no science at all.
No, to me it seems like, you know, whatever the fad of the moment is.
Yes.
And that includes, the fad can often include medication of the week.
Well, that too, yes. Absolutely.
You know, and you see that quite often, you know, it's like, this week our disease is going to be schizophrenia.
Well,
you know?
Yes, right, that's right, yes.
And that's kind of, you know, you kind of become concerned when it's diagnosed by the fad of the week or year, however you want to put it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and too often I think that's no more than what it is.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
But you listen to people talk, you know, and out of academia, again, this is a frequent thing, that we are purely biological entities. You know, we're conceived, we are born, we live our lives, and then we die and become worm food.
That's right.
You know, I'm thinking, you know, that's a very boring outlook. And what's the point to doing anything?
Well, that's a very good question. That's right. What is the point? I mean, why bother to be a biologist and come up with a conclusion like that? You might as well enjoy yourself.
Yeah, there's more to this equation than that. Otherwise, you know, hey, I'll just be, you know, some sort of a hobo and just tootle around and do whatever the heck I want.
That's right.
You know, why would I apply myself to studying anything? Because
exactly.
I don't know, I'm going to be worm food in a few years.
Exactly, yeah. Well, and since, I mean, since most people are, even if they don't, let's say, intellectually assent to that idea, because it is drummed into us, unless you personally make it your business to disprove it, as it were, to your own satisfaction, and not to live that way, that's how you do live. And that is, I mean, that's what's behind the chaos, in part, at any rate, it's what's behind the chaos and the unhappiness and the craziness and all the rest. It's that people do not have, collectively, and not all that many individually, have this sense of meaning in their lives. And that's one of the reasons why Egypt is so interesting, because there you have an entire civilization in which you can be sure, to keep it going for 3,000 years, it had to be emotionally, psychologically, spiritually, deeply gratifying, simply in order to keep going that long. And when you look at what they did, getting back to "by their fruits you shall know them," miserable, unhappy, desperate, and psychotic people couldn't produce that kind of work. Masterpieces are not produced by sometimes they're produced in the modern world. Some of the very best artists are not terribly well balanced, but they're not crazy. Some of them are. I mean, nowadays artists function as the sensitive nerve ends of the society, and since it is a psychotic society, the creative people, because they are the most sensitive, are the most deeply affected by it, usually in a very negative way. There's not much contemporary art or music or literature that, let's say, honors the gods.
No, that seems to have gone out of fashion.
Definitely out of fashion.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we aren't currently... I mean, when you look at any great monuments of the past, the great cathedrals, the huge temples, the pyramids, these other massive, important structures that people regularly tour. I mean, even right up to the Eiffel Tower, the Statue of Liberty, all that kind of stuff. What has been created in the last 50 years that causes the same amount of awe?
Not a lot.
Offhand, I can't think of anything.
There's some pretty good music out there.
I'm talking of physical structures. Music, I mean,
very little architecture. Almost none.
We don't build that kind of monument anymore.
Almost none anymore. No, I mean, it's all Trump Towers and garbage like that.
It's nothing certainly dedicated to any sort of a spiritual or religious aspect.
Almost never.
Even, you know, your great educational facilities, when you look at what they're building, you really can't tell the difference between it, a hospital and a factory.
Nope. That's right.
They all look pretty much the same.
And I keep repeating it, by their fruits you shall know them. I mean,
yeah, we're kind of a boring society at this point, I think, in terms of that. We don't have any collective interest into building anything beautiful.
Because it's not cost effective.
No.
By and large. That's one of the reasons why the architecture is so terrible, because economics play such a huge role in it that to do something just for the sake of doing it, because that's what that honors the gods, is almost unthinkable in terms of architecture. You can still do it. You can do it if you're a painter or a sculptor or a writer or a poet, because you drag it out from inside yourself, and you're not, I mean, other than putting food on the table, you don't have to worry about satisfying the bean counters.
Right. Right. And, you know, it's kind of sad to think that our society is never going to be known for contributions to architecture.
It sure won't, you bet.
You know, if we try to think about what we will be known for, you know, what will it be? For the invention of the Internet?
Well, actually, that's one of the few good things. Maybe.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we've got some great things, you know, but I've often said, like, space, okay? Our space exploration project is sort of like, often it's like studying the oceans from Iowa. I mean, it's real, you can do it, I suppose, but it's pretty tough.
I must say, I'm rather un. Space travel absolutely doesn't move me at all. I mean, I think it's a waste of time and money.
Uh-huh.
And it's a purely external pursuit, you know? Although,
uh-huh,
when you get up there, the astronauts got up there and had a mystical experience because what they saw was so fabulous. But the actual going through all that time and trouble to get up in the air and wear that horrible suit, I mean, I just can't imagine, you know.
Well, I have to admit, I have seen the suits that were being designed. There were the prototypes that were being designed for the Mars trip.
Yeah.
Which may or may not happen at some future point. And they were much, much better.
Well, maybe.
Than those original ones.
Maybe. But it's just the real exploration is within, not without. And it's actually, I wrote when the first moon landing took place, whenever that was, what, 60s or something? And I remember
in the 60s, yeah.
Something like that. I remember sitting down and writing a long, short story. It's very funny. One of the few things that I've written that's never been published, about the first Mars mission. And it's entirely about when the astronaut goes off to Mars, but it's what happens back on Earth, where his wife is having an affair with the garbage man. And the whole story is about her affair. And then this guy comes down from Mars and is about to write a book called Man Conquers the Universe. Actually, it's a very funny story. But basically, that's it. Who cares about what's going on in space? The real problem is right here, and the real problem is us.
Yeah, do you see much hope for mankind, though?
Do I?
Yeah.
Well, yes and no. When things get bad enough, it shakes people loose. And it's getting that bad now, pretty soon. And once people stop taking themselves for granted, and once they stop listening to authority, if they stop listening to authority, people can get open to other possibilities. And once they're open to other possibilities, then stuff starts happening. There is a counter movement on the air. That's what we're talking. I mean, we couldn't probably, even this little conversation almost certainly couldn't have taken place on a radio station 50 years ago.
No.
Probably not. There's an audience for it now. People are coming unstuck, and some people, at any rate, are recognizing that there's important things that their education never covered. And actually, our video, our Mystery of the Sphinx video, and the one with Charlton Heston, did you see that? Did you ever see that?
No,
back in the 90s. But all about the water weathering of the Sphinx. And this was an NBC primetime special that was, at that time, one of the most successful documentaries ever shown. It had an audience of 30 million people.
You know, I think of it, I may have seen it or a clip from it at some
point. Probably. Because it was around a lot. But anyway, it had an audience of 30 million people. That's a lot of people.
Yeah.
And it was not a trashy show. It was really, miraculously, NBC let us do it our own way. And they changed almost nothing. And yes, it was, you know, it had a glitch to it because it was network, and we had the old Charlton Heston there doing the, who did a wonderful job actually as the host. And it was a lot of science. It was all about geology, and the implications of the geology was that the Great Sphinx was much, much older than anyone thought, meaning that all of our contemporary assumptions about civilization and when it started and how it all happened had to be completely changed, and that was a very successful show. So, the interest is there. So, do I hold out hope for all mankind? No, I think we're in for really bad times. I mean, I think the whole thing is coming unstuck. Empire America is on its way out, but empires are bad for the planet, so. But it's a lot of people are going to be.
Well,
it's going to be very painful.
You know, that old
it's
saying
going to be
about,
very painful for a lot of people, for sure.
Yeah, there's that old saying about history repeats itself. And in terms of history, societies such as ours have a finite lifetime, and.
Always.
Ours reaching the end of its term?
Well, it is. It is. And yes, I mean, other empires. I mean, all empires sooner or later have caved in, and this one is in the process of caving in now. And anyone who doesn't see that, as far as I'm concerned, is deluding themselves, because it's happening. And the wise and the prudent will be taking some sort of measures or be somewhere where, when a lot of unlovely stuff hits the fan, they have an escape route of some sort, be it physical or emotional or, anyway, a way to ride out the chaos, because I think that's what's coming up.
Yeah, the time of chaos is always traumatic. Well, change is always traumatic.
That's right.
You know,
always.
Even if it's a change for the better,
it's still change, that's right.
Trauma.
And very often the change for the better follows a very, very rough period. I mean, lots of people who have had terrible experiences, if they've survived the terrible experiences, come out the stronger for it and said, gee, I wouldn't have missed that for the world. Often.
Yeah, and too, there's the other saying that there can never be construction without destruction occurring
first. Well, that's right.
You've got to clear the land, as the saying goes,
well, exactly.
So you can build that monument.
Yep, exactly. Actually, on my website, I've got a little essay about exactly that. About civilization is like a park, and when the park keepers, who should be the priests and the poets and the scientists and the philosophers, are drunk or crazy, the whole thing goes into disrepair, and the great trees are rotting and all the rest, and the brambles and the poison ivy springs up all over the place. And to restore the park, well, you have to, first of all, you have to cut down all of those rotting old trees, and then with a chainsaw and a flamethrower, you've got to burn out the brambles and the poison ivy, and then the work of replanting the park takes place, and, you know, things have to be planted, and they have to be nurtured, and they grow, and they're very tender. They can be trampled into the ground by any wandering jackass. But that's how civilizations work. I mean, that's how the organic process works. Out of the chaos comes new life. But without the chaos, without the chaos, nothing happens. I mean, it just dies. But the chaos is part of the process. It's like winter. At least winter down there in Louisiana isn't much of a winter, I guess, but...
Well, it was quite traumatic this year. My banana trees were actually killed by the cold.
Really? Oh, well, yeah.
Yeah, it was We had a spell of unusually cold water. Weather,
oh, yeah, right. I remember reading that.
In.
Really? Yeah.
I had frozen pipes. Obviously, I had frozen plants. It was quite cold, and it stayed that way far longer than usual. It's not unusual to get down in the 20s
really?
One or two nights.
Yeah.
But in, you know, most of our plants, you know, even my banana trees, they can handle that.
No, they don't have
but a week of it, no, they cannot.
No. But here in the Northeast, you really know when it's winter, and when spring comes, it's a big change.
And I have experienced life on the northern Great Plains where the drifts of snow, I remember a storm occurring in the mid-70s. We had 20 and 30-foot drifts.
Wow, yeah.
They lost cattle and hogs in the storm.
Right.
Now, remember that spring when it thawed? They found a hog that had been lost. He was a big boar. He had been before the storm.
Yes.
He was much smaller when they found him comes the melt.
Really?
Yeah, he had survived underneath that snowbank all winter long.
Really? That's amazing. That's incredible.
Everybody was quite amazed by that particular pig.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
Yeah. So it just goes to show that even when things look pretty bad, some life will survive.
Oh, yeah. It really is an organic and cosmic process. And when you see it, when it's unmistakable, when you see it happening all around you, and, you know, we're not hogs in a snowbank, well, at least some of us aren't hogs in a snowbank, you take an inventory, basically, you take notice of where you are, and what you're doing, and what the bigger picture is, and, you know, make whatever moves have to be made in order to allow you to ride out the storm. I mean, it'll be different for different people, but when you see it coming, if you're wise, you try to make whatever provisions you can, and with the understanding that they may not work, because it's when the chaos comes, it doesn't. It doesn't just spare the nice guys.
Right. Well, guess what has happened? We have come to the end of the program.
We have,
so
haven't we?
Yeah, it's all too quick.
Well, I apologize for being... What did you do for the half hour that I wasn't there?
Everyone got to listen to music.
What?
Everyone got to listen to music.
Until
maybe 5-10 minutes before... We'd started playing a rerun program, but,
My apologies to the audience again.
Those in the podcast won't miss a thing because they'll catch the whole conversation. And I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, dear.
I had a great, great time, and you were a great guest.
Thank you.
Well worth waiting for.
Well, I'm around, so anytime... anytime you want me, and chances are we'll find an evening, and the next time, guaranteed, I'll tattoo it on the back of my hand that I won't forget.
Okay.
Okay?
All right. Well, folks, I hope that you enjoyed the program with John Anthony West tonight as much as I have, and that you found that it provided you plenty of food for thought and some more illumination for your personal journey towards truth. Join us again next week for another episode of The Dawn of Shade. Sure to bring you another fascinating conversation. With that, we are out of time. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and good night.
Thank you, Gia.